Imagine showing up to a job each day, completing your tasks, and then, after months of work, never seeing a dime for your time and efforts. What would you do? Who would you call? Each year, hundreds of thousands of people find themselves in this exact scenario. It happens across every industry, but runs rampant in low-wage, labor-driven sectors such as retail, restaurants, agriculture, and manufacturing, where there's typically a large population of minority and immigrant workers. When this happens in Chicago, Laura Garza is on call, ready to help. Garza is the worker-centered director at Arise Chicago, an organization that empowers people by helping them to understand their rights and fight injustice in the workplace. This organization began in 2002 and over the years has worked with thousands of employees to help recover more than $8.3 million in owed wages and compensation. Garza highlights one case in particular that occurred during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic last year.
It's basically a group of 14 workers. They were hired by three individuals to work out of a basement to make masks during COVID. And these workers collectively are owed over $98,000. And so they came to us and we met with these workers, did Know Your Rights trainings. That's the first step that we do. And then asked the workers what they wanted to do in terms of next steps. And so we recently just did a delegation to one of these employers' other business that this individual has to demand they get paid. And ironically, here are these essential workers making masks. And, you know, we're suspicious about some of the funding that was coming to these three individuals. And anyways, these workers decided that they needed to take action. And they collectively did that. Out of the 14 workers, some of them showed up and we marched into this employer's business and demanded they get paid.
As of late June, the case is still ongoing. Despite confronting the employer, the 14 workers still haven't been paid what they're owed and are now actively pursuing possible litigation for wages withheld. While it may seem surprising that a business can avoid paying close to $100,000 in wages, Garza says it happens time and time again. In these situations, worker centers provide direction and resources to laborers needing assistance, but are not a one-stop solution to people's problems.
Some of the misconception that comes from workers is they think that by coming to us, we're going to, you know, write that letter and demand they get paid, and they don't realize that we're going to be pushing for them to be involved. And just the whole leadership development that we do with workers, I think that to some workers, that's like, wow, like there's a lot more than just calling the worker center to resolve their issues. They actually have to be involved. They actually have to recruit other workers to come to our meeting. They have to be willing to take direct action in cases that we're taking. I think that they come with a conception that we're going to solve their issues, and it's really them stepping up and taking, just empowering themselves to take action and demand what is owed to them. And we're not in the business of helping workers. We're in the business of supporting, educating, building confidence among workers, building a commitment to solidarity.
It can be a fearful and nerve-wracking process for workers to stand up together and directly confront employers about wages, health, and safety concerns or ill treatment. But this method of resolution is often the best avenue, unless the issue is escalated to legal or governmental systems, which can sometimes take months or even years to resolve.
We try to do direct action, assuming that's what the workers want to do. We try to avoid litigation if we can, or going to government agencies, although they've been, obviously, both routes have been helpful, but they just are lengthy. And so the best route for us, and we're, you know, one of the things that we stress with workers is if they're willing to take that step to do a delegation and confront the boss, which most of them, they get there.
You may be wondering, where are the unions in these situations? The reality is that many domestic laborers are not unionized and don't have a formal representative that will step in and act on their behalf.
Unions typically represent particular types of workers, like auto workers or mine workers or flight attendants or teachers.
That's Dr. Celeste Monforton, a lecturer in the Department of Health and Human Performance at Texas State University and the co-author of the new book, On the Job: The Untold Story of Worker Centers and the New Fight for Wages, Dignity, and Health. Monforton says that unions and worker centers both function in similar ways, but unions are much larger entities that are heavily structured and work directly with employers to create a formal collective bargaining agreement. This includes negotiated wage contracts, sick leave, benefits, and more, all formalized in writing and agreed upon before the work begins.
If we think about the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, there's an international kind of at the top of the family tree, and they'll have a large executive board, they'll have a health and benefits and pensions department, they'll have policy. And then on the ground are all the local unions whose members will negotiate their employment conditions with a particular employer or a group of employers. And the members will pay dues to the union. And I would just close by saying that unions deserve all the credit for the labor protections and standards that are the law in our country and that we come to expect in a civil society, like prohibitions on child labor, overtime pay, safety protections, job security, and that is the important role that unions have played here in the U.S., but also around the globe.
On the other hand, Munforton says that a worker center is more of a community-based organization, typically made up of a small staff that shifts their resources depending on what the local area needs. They act more in a responsive capacity to resolve worker issues and can also extend into a variety of other roles, from career development skills training to helping people resolve housing issues.
Some of them offer language classes, English classes, maybe computer classes. Some of the worker centers we visited provide some healthcare services, definitely some legal assistance, whether it's on tenants' rights or discrimination. But of course, a lot of the focus is on working conditions. So worker centers have been very successful both in assisting an individual worker or an individual or small group of workers, you know, to get paid, but also very instrumental in changing laws so that there are more consequences for employers who would engage in that injustice.
Munforton points out that many worker centers are instrumental drivers in creating or tightening county and state laws that protect low-wage laborers. In addition, there are some larger networks of worker centers that have created a regional or national alliance.
They'll exchange tactics and strategies or share information about the problems that workers and their particular worker centers are experiencing, and maybe another worker center had that same issue, and they share the information about the approach. It's a way to build a larger community of individuals who have a shared experience, shared in the sense of that they are immigrants, shared in the sense that they don't speak English, shared in the sense that they have experienced some abuse or injustice on the job.
You may not have heard of worker centers before this segment, but they've been acting behind the scenes for decades, operating out of office spaces or community centers in both large cities and small towns. The end goal of these organizations is to advocate for minorities, immigrants, and low-wage workers who often fall through the cracks. Through education and awareness, the aim is to keep building a network of members that are stronger together than alone. And in order to keep this community resource afloat, each member contributes through monthly dues. Munforton says the cost per person varies from center to center.
So some worker centers, for example, in Great California, the Great Worker Center, they charge $5 a month for individuals to be members. Other worker centers, for example, in Massachusetts, the Immigrant Worker Center affiliated with MassCosh, they don't have a membership fee. What they require is that if a worker comes needing assistance, perhaps they were injured on the job, and so they need help finding an attorney to maneuver through the workers' compensation system, the Immigrant Worker Center will match that worker up with an attorney who will assist them. And in exchange, the workers are required to attend training class about labor rights, about OSHA, and will have to participate in at least three activities. And that might be supporting another worker that has to go to before a judge on a workers' compensation case, or it may be attending a rally at the state capitol about a requirement for sick leave.
These centers try to keep the cycle going by having people who have been helped return the favor to others. Garza at Arise Chicago says that locals often find out about the Workers' Center through word of mouth or through social media.
Social media has played a huge role in workers contacting us. Arise is pretty savvy around using Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp. A lot of workers actually find us through WhatsApp, find our organizers through WhatsApp, and use WhatsApp as an organizing tool amongst themselves. That's another way that they actually contact us.
If you're a worker who needs help or you're interested in volunteering your time at a local worker center, simply search online for the closest center near you. To find out more about this topic and our guests, Laura Garza and Dr. Celeste Monforton, visit viewpointsradio.org. This segment was written and produced by Amira Zaveri. I'm Gary Price.
Oregon's Tillamook County Creamery Association produces dairy products you know and love. In fact, the farmer-owned co-op makes award-winning cheese and is now the fastest-growing family-size ice cream brand in the country. Its commitment to stewardship informs every decision the co-op makes, and it's getting noticed. The company was recognized by Fast Company as a World Changing Ideas Award Honorable Mention recipient. And in 2020, Tillamook achieved status as a certified B Corporation. There are plenty more good stewardship examples in their newly released Good is Something We Make Together stewardship report. Here's Paul Snyder, Executive Vice President of Stewardship at Tillamook County Creamery Association.
When COVID hit, our farmer owners stepped up with a $4 million relief fund to help support employees, nonprofits, and local businesses in the communities where we operate. And we've donated 10% of September profits to the Alpha Farmer Initiative to protect at-risk farmland and provide grants to up-and-coming farmers all over the country. We've also reduced water use, made advances in cow care, and joined the global fight against food waste.
The Tillamook County Creamery Association is owned by around 80 Oregon farming families and has been around for 112 years. Find out how they're a force for good in the world at tillamook.com/stewardship.
Cardiovascular or CV disease is the number one killer of adults in the U.S., and millions of people trying to reduce their risk of a heart attack or stroke may unknowingly be taking medications that are not proven nor FDA approved to reduce cardiovascular risk. Let's hear from cardiologist Dr. John Osborne.
Many people are unaware that after a failed outcome study, the FDA revoked the approval of fenofibrates when added to statins, as the risk outweighed the benefits to heart health. It's important to remember that statins, along with diet and exercise, can lower cardiovascular risk by about 25 to 35%. But persistent cardiovascular risk, which can lead to a life-threatening event, may remain. I would tell anyone still being prescribed fenofibrates, such as Tricor and Trilipix, with a statin, to talk to their doctor about FDA-approved therapies for cardiovascular risk reduction.
To learn more and get clear on the facts, visit itscleartomenow.com. Again, that's itscleartomenow.com.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Viewpoints is a production of MediaTrax Communications. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows. And find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
Coming up on Viewpoints.
Teenagers are impulsive. They are unable to weigh risks and consequences as well as adults can. And they're uniquely pliable. They can grow, they can change, they can mature.
Is it ethical to sentence a teen to life in prison without parole? Then,
there are so many things that are present for you if you slow down, take your time, ask questions, say thank you.
The upside to traveling more consciously. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.